This is All Things Considered on 90.1 WABE. I'm Dennis O'Hare with the second of two conversations with the candidates in the Republican runoff for U.S. Senate. Congressman Jack Kingston joins us at the White House restaurant in Buckhead, where he has been campaigning. Congressman, welcome.
Thank you, Dennis. Great to be with you.
In the latest showdown, if you will, over a possible government shutdown, you voted against raising the debt ceiling. It certainly is something that plays well with many folks who are going to be voting in this primary. But if you are elected to the Senate, is it the kind of difficult choice that one has to make in order to avoid the consequences of a possible default?
Well, Dennis, debt ceiling votes are always difficult. And I've voted against 14 of them as a member of Congress. There have been a few related to the war in Iraq and some Social Security shortfalls that I've supported, but those also set up a spending reform that in a couple of cases led to a balanced budget back when we had the majority in the House and the Senate. So when we have these government shutdowns that culminate in somewhat of a bargain between the two parties, usually a key element of it is, are we reforming something so that we're not in that situation again, or at least for a long while. Ultimately, of course, we need to get our house in order and not have these showdowns.
But does it make sense to use the debt ceiling, which, first of all, doesn't talk about future debt? It talks about the bills we've already rung up. And secondly, could cause the kinds of financial uncertainty that we saw the last time. Does it make sense to use that as the bargaining chip when you're trying to get reform long term?
You know, unfortunately, right now, America is somewhat split. We're having a huge national debate on, and you can almost boil down every question out there, from the war to healthcare to education, on two issues: the size of government and who's going to pay for it. And that debate is so deep and so profound that we have this big philosophical divide in America. Therefore, often you get into these situations of year-end government shutdowns or the debt ceiling debates. And that, unfortunately, is sometimes the only way you get both parties to sit down at a table and hammer out an agreement. So using the debt ceiling or the year-end government potential shutdown as a vehicle to negotiate is not unusual. It is not unprecedented at all. But to me, the key thing is to have both parties at the table and come up with reforms that will make a correction in our spending.
On that point, though, is it possible to, simply by spending cuts, get your way out of our long-term deficit? Or eventually, even as Senator Chambliss has said on occasion, you have to put revenue on the table.
Well, Dennis, I believe that we have a spending problem, not a taxing problem. I believe that the tax level is sufficient. We do not have to increase taxes, but what we do have to do is go after the duplications. We need to go after the waste. We need to go after some of the programs that just have outserved or outlived their purpose. But the other thing is, remember that if we push back on the regulatory burden, businesses can expand. And when businesses build up their inventory, buying more supplies and adding on new locations, there are more jobs out there, more people are hired, less people are on public assistance, more people are paying into the system rather than receiving from the system. And that, to me, is the way to grow the economy, and it will help us address these fiscal issues.
But will it do it all? In other words, growth is fine, spending cuts are fine, but will they be enough? Or do we have to really take a comprehensive look, as the Simpson-Bowles Commission did and other groups have as well, and say, look, we really have to take a look at whether we can simply pass tax cut after tax cut and continue the spending we've been doing?
You know, both Kennedy and Reagan cut taxes and experienced after that some of the longest booms that we've had in the economy. So I'm in favor of lower taxes as a way to grow the economy and spending cuts.
On the point of social services, for instance, you have talked about work for public benefits. Isn't it true, though, that a lot of people who are on public assistance are also working? They're already doing that. So doesn't that talk about a bigger problem about what some folks call income inequality?
Well, I think that what President Obama did in reversing some of President Clinton's signed into law welfare reform policies about the work requirement, I think it was a disservice, because I think having a work requirement for able-bodied adults on public assistance is a long-term investment that gets people back into the economic ladder so that they can move up and become independent. So I do think that the work requirement is more than just math. There's a work ethic that you regain, and it's something we need to regain in our country.
But does that address those who are already working and are either qualifying for food stamps or having their kids qualify for programs like Georgia's Peach Care, which is federally funded?
You know, I think it's a step in the right direction. I'll say this, that when we did welfare reform back as part of the contract with America, working with President Clinton, now I'm a little fuzzy on these numbers, but I believe there were 14 million people on welfare. That the welfare reform, along with some economic reforms, led to a boom, and the number, I believe, dropped from 14 to 5 million people. So I think that we have seen very positive results on welfare reform.
Yet the problem for many people of not even making enough to stand on their own 2 feet while working persists. Why not raise the federal minimum wage?
Well, economically, whenever you raise the minimum wage, you eliminate jobs. And most of those jobs are on the entry level, the opportunity, and this restaurant in which we're sitting. If you raise the minimum wage, he's going to see, and I'm not picking on this restaurant, I'm just saying generally this is what we hear from restaurants and small business owners, that look, instead of having 8 people, we're going to see what we can do with 7 people. And so often it's that first time into the workplace employee who suffers when we increase the minimum wage. But and if we look right now, and I do not remember the Western city, is it Portland, who raised their minimum wage so high that now they're seeing the consequences of it, and they're trying to back off it because of the unintended consequences.
But then how do we address a persistent problem of a widening gap and a middle class that is struggling to stay in the game, and folks who are not making even that much who really can't seem to find a way out?
You know, part of it is to create an atmosphere where you do have a healthy, upwardly mobile middle class and eliminate some of the crony capitalism that's going on right now. There's this perception that big business and big government don't get along, yet so many times we see big business and big government coming up with some sort of regulatory scheme that actually eliminates competition. And so smaller businesses, the mom and the pop businesses, can't thrive because they can't compete, because they can't get over the regulatory hurdles that are put in front of them. And I think part of income equality is making sure that, you know, everybody has an opportunity to shine. Everybody has that opportunity to experience the American dream. For some, it might mean owning a bicycle shop that becomes a chain. For some, it's another type business. For some, it's being a very productive professor, like my dad was. But we do absolutely need to have a vibrant middle class. And I think crony capitalism is one of the things that caps it.
You mentioned regulations a moment ago. The administration has proposed carbon emission limits over the next 30 years. Part of the argument against it has been, well, it will stifle business. It will make it very difficult. It will make it very expensive. But given the problems we've had with our air over the last few decades, isn't something like that what you need to get innovation going? In other words, if there's no deadline, if there's no sort of push to fix the problem, will the problem ever get fixed?
I think this is actually an example of the Obama administration overreaching and going around the legislative branch. As you know, the Obama EPA mandate is more severe than the cap and trade program, which the Democrats could not pass when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House and Harry Reid, the leader of the Senate. And so what the president has done is, in going around the legislative branch, has missed the opportunity for hearings to talk about these things, to make sure that there are not unintended consequences. That's, to me, one of the big problems of doing an end-around. But the other issue is, in the last 10 years, our air admissions have been somewhat level. But during that period of time, China's have gone up about 170%, India about 90%. So if the administration is sincere about a global climate change issue, to do it unilaterally really disarms us economically, and meanwhile the biggest culprits, China and India, are exempted. And so I also fear that American companies will say, you know what, we can't handle the regulatory lopsidedness of doing business in America, so we're going to start moving overseas.
Couldn't it be argued, though, that the innovation that might be prompted by something like this to come up with a solution that other countries could then use could actually help American business in a way that says, okay, we have a solution to a global problem here and the world's going to have to come to us?
I don't know why China would feel like they would have to come to us. What, because based on the pattern of what we've seen in China, you know, they like to imitate what we do and then do it less expensively. They're masters of getting around whatever our regulatory burden is.
On Obamacare, are we at a point where repealing it is not realistic for a number of reasons, number of practical reasons? It is starting to take hold in some places. We've had successes in states like Kentucky, for instance. Is it possible that Republicans really have to look at, okay, we need to fix some things here, make some changes within it, rather than go for a complete repeal?
No, I think we need to repeal it. And keep in mind, Obamacare is not even fully implemented. I believe that this administration has exempted or waived temporarily 23 different major sections of it, and cleverly designing those waivers to expire right after the election, which to me shows how disingenuous this administration is about their own health care plan. I think that we need to have a market-based, patient-centered healthcare system that makes healthcare more affordable and more accessible. Keep in mind that Obamacare was supposed to bring down the premiums for each family $2,500. It's had the opposite effect. There has been nothing in Obamacare to address the increase in cost of healthcare. Americans are also very mad that they can't keep their doctor, can't keep their policy. And again, remember, we only have our feet halfway in the water on Obamacare. I believe once it's fully implemented, if it does come to being fully implemented, there will be even more problems.
Isn't part of the difficulty, though, that for every story that you cited about somebody whose premiums went up, somebody who wasn't able to keep the plan that they had, that there are people who have not been able to afford insurance before who now can, so it's hard to tell, okay, is this working or is it not, especially as it's implemented? Doesn't it deserve to at least have a chance?
I think that the only thing that's hard to tell is the way this administration keeps the books. The numbers are never quite the numbers once you get past the headline and look at it. I think if you look at the pros and cons of Obamacare, that Obamacare needs to be repealed.
One of the points that your opponent, Mr. Perdue, has made in his campaign is you are a career politician, career member, you're a longtime member of Congress. Given the ratings that Congress has among the public, has that been a hurdle for you to overcome? And what would you say to somebody who says, okay, you've been in there since 1993, you've had a chance, and Congress has become less and less effective?
Well, I've come home every single weekend. I've never lost my Georgia perspective. I remember who I am, where I came from, what I went to Washington to do, which is why we've been able to put together an incredibly wide and varied coalition. You know, I'm supported by Newt Gingrich, Sean Hannity, Eric Erickson, Karen Handel, Phil Gingrey, the majority of the congressional delegation, the NRA, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We have a very wide coalition, including three of the Tea Party founders. And it's because I've come home I've listened to people. I haven't hidden myself behind some gate somewhere. I return phone calls. I have open mic town meetings, show up for appointments. As a candidate, I've been on the streets. I was in, just one example, I was in 4 Fourth of July parades. In 3 of those parades, my opponent's empty van was driving down the road. He was back home on Sea Island. I was out there meeting people, shaking hands, listening to the voters, and walking the rope lines with lots of other volunteers. Not all the questions that I got were friendly, go get them, Jack, type questions. But I think that a known representative who has voted conservatively versus somebody who's unknown, who has been all over the place in terms of some of his positions, I don't think that's what America needs right now.
Congressman Jack Kingston joining us at the White House restaurant in Buckhead. The runoff is July 22nd. Congressman, thanks so much for being with us and for giving us this time. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Dan. It's great to be here, and let's go eat an omelet.